it's great to be here. This is an honor for me to be here with you. And I've been an admirer of Catherine and her work for many years. And for those of you, some of you seem to know who I am, others don't. So I've been writing books about UFOs. My first book I published in 2000, so 18 years ago. And I've been researching the phenomenon through most of the 1990s. Prior to that, I was working on a PhD in U.S. diplomatic history, all about Harry Truman and the Russians and the birth of the CIA. And then I was in a bookstore, saw a UFO conspiracy book, Above Top Secret, the UFO Cover-Up, the Worldwide Cover-Up, and I thought, wow. And even in the 90s, everyone was aware that there were claims of a UFO cover-up. I knew nothing about those claims, but I was studying the world of 1950 in a lot of detail, and I knew that, you know, the claims of a cover-up were all dealing with the 1940s and 50s. So I thought, well, if this is a thing, if this is a real thing, then I'm curious it hadn't turned up in any academic history book. Why is that? I bought this particular book, read it all the way through. It was a great book. I'm good friends with that author, this Timothy Good. And I was hooked, more than hooked, I was obsessed. And I spent the next many years going through the entire bibliography of what were then the published works on UFOs. And I just wanted to know, is this, you know, to what extent is this a historical fact of our world, and to what extent is it not? And how strong is the argument of the believers, and how strong is the argument of the skeptics, and all of those things that you would do when you dive into something that's totally new and totally unexpected to your worldview. And so I've certain things I'm good at doing. One is reading books and taking detailed notes and writing very, very analytical analytical notes. So actually during the 90s, I ended up writing before I wrote my book, I wrote a 500-page book, which was a chronology of all of the data that I'd collected, and with proper citations. I had it all laid out, hundreds of books and sources, and I created a chronology that was itself a 500-page book. And on that basis, I wrote my first book, which was called UFOs and the National Security State. And that was a groundbreaking book in the field. Looking back on it now, I can easily see it with some perspective. It opened up area of the political analysis of the UFO phenomenon, and I've been going down that road ever since. Since that time, my interest in the phenomenon have gone from much more than just the politics and the cover-up. It's everything. It's the whole thing, because it's you can't just go to a great big ocean and stick your little toe in. This is a field that's so multifarious and so so varied, so deep, so paradigm-shattering, that you just can't help it. And the only thing I'll say by way of introduction is, the resistance that I had, I was in my early 30s when I first encountered this. And, you know, back then I thought I was way ahead of the curve, like a lot of you. You know, you're smart people. I was a smart young guy, and I was well-educated. Like, I was really well-educated in the field of history. And so I thought I'd put a few things together. I thought I'd understood that there's, you know, the kind of mass reality. I'll talk about that in this lecture, I think, yes. And then there's more sophisticated levels of reality. And I thought that I had encountered that. And the hardest thing for me to do is to realize that I didn't know. I didn't know a lot. And it was a blow to my ego. But just as importantly, it was a blow to my whole worldview. And I realized I had to put aside a lot of what I thought I knew and start the painful process of reintegrating a new worldview. And what's interesting, you know, like in The Matrix, where Neo takes the red pill and reality becomes clear to him. It's kind of like that, except I wish it were just one red pill, right? Like where you take one red pill and your reality becomes clear. It's not like that with this field or with any of these things. Like you take a red pill and you realize, oh my God, UFOs really are real. Like my first year into this, I honestly spent nights staring at the ceiling, thinking, if this is real, what does it say about the history that I thought I knew? I had to rethink what I thought of, say, the Kennedy administration or Eisenhower, or any of the historical things I thought I'd studied. There's this big piece that was never discussed by academic historians. So I finally took that first red pill, and I thought, okay, well, there's a lot here now that I understand. But then, like, it's not just one red pill. You have to take many, and it never stops. Like, another one was, well, wait a minute. So where was the mainstream media? Like, where was the New York Times? If this is real, you would think they would have competent reporters who would be wanting to break the story, and yet they didn't. Why didn't they? So that took me down this other rabbit hole of media manipulation of the intelligence community, by the intelligence community. And that's, boy, is that a whole story. You could spend a lifetime on that alone. And then other rabbit holes, like, where's the academic community? I was so deeply on the academic path. That's what I thought I wanted to be, just king of my classroom, teaching in some university. And so where were the scholars? Like, why were they asleep at the switch? And then, you know, that took me down the entire relationship of the academic community to the national security state. And that's an important relationship indeed. And on and on and on. And so what I ended up, like, you know, after, as the years go by, I was ripping away so many little layers of veils of illusion. I guess I lost track. And the next thing that happened is, like, every time I would take a flight and someone would sit next to me looking at their little Excel spreadsheet for the next quarter, and they'd say, oh, so what do you do? Like, I wouldn't know what to say to them. I study a reality that, you know, you think is fantasy, but is actually really significant. Now I'm at the point where I just tell everybody. I'm totally upfront about it. And what I discover is people love to hear about this. There's a great hunger. There's a great, great hunger in this world for information on this subject. People often are not aware of it. They don't let themselves become aware of it because there's so much, even now, still ridicule, dismissal, and so forth. When I walked away from the academic world, though, and some of my former colleagues thought I had lost my mind, I can look back and say, the joke's on you. I've had some of the most unbelievable friendships as a result, with Catherine, with a man who once walked on the moon, Edgar Mitchell of Apollo 14, who's now deceased, with people who've briefed U.S. presidents, high-level defense officials, and all of whom are into this subject. They're not shouting it from the rooftops, but they are interested in it for sure. And so all of this was encouragement to me to continue on my path, and that's really what has brought me here to you today. So this lecture I've called The Cost of Secrecy really developed out of a conversation that I had with Catherine and her article that she wrote in one of the Solari quarterly updates on Control 101. I assume many of you have read it. If you haven't, you should. It's excellent. Excellent. So some of her ideas have made it into this lecture, and then other ideas that I've been developing as well. So this is, oh, thank you, Catherine. So let me just get started. So I call it The Cost of Secrecy, from Money to Mind Control. So we'll start with UFOs. And again, I realize some of you are very involved and knowledgeable of this subject, others not so much. That's fine. So, you know, like when you watch a TV special on UFOs, and it's, I mean, unless maybe with Ancient Aliens they don't do that anymore, but with a lot of these mainstreamish types of documentaries, they always give you like the, well, what if they're out there? Maybe they're here. What if they're here? What if there's life out there? They pose these questions in such a way, I've come to believe, in a way that's, it is a form of disinformation. I only say that the TV producers who do these shows often really don't know much about the subject. And I know this because I've met a lot of them, and they're just given a job, and it's like, I got to do a UFO thing. Okay, great. But in reality, like, even posing the question in that way is a form of deception. Because I can tell you that within the classified world, within elements of the classified world, it is known full well that this is a totally real phenomenon that involves incredible technology that is not supposed to exist, and it does exist, and it has been existing. And I'm going to show you a couple of snippets of documents in a moment just to give you an indication of what I'm talking about. But it's a real thing. In fact, early on in my own research, I met with a gentleman whose dad was military, long military. I think it was a major in the Air Force. And apparently his dad had some encounter with this phenomenon while in the military, and on one occasion just said to his son, it's real and they're here. I've never forgotten that quote. I thought it's very pithy. One thing that I'm going to suggest as I continue on here with you today is that this phenomenon really kind of inserted itself into our history in an open way at a kind of a possibly a bad time. That is, the UFO phenomenon didn't just drop into our laps. It dropped into the laps of the national security apparatus of the United States, who became aware of it in a big way in the 1940s, at a time when they were transforming themselves into something very different, and a time when the world was in the process of transforming itself into something very different. So it's almost an intersection of two paths as I'm currently seeing it. And as I say here, it's a time when global financial elites began to initiate their latest revolution. I will come back to that. But for now, I'll just say that this phenomenon has created a definite, powerful interest by the United States military. If I had to go on CNN or MSNBC or Fox or whatever and talk about UFOs, one thing I could absolutely do with complete confidence against any army of skeptics you throw at me is that this phenomenon, wherever it's from, whatever the origination of it, is confirmable and has generated extreme levels of concern from highest levels of our national security. So that's a fact. You could take that to the bank, as long as it's not J.P. Morgan or Chase or whatever. So, but you could take it to the bank. And so I'm going to. It's not hints. It's not suggestions. It is proof. And I'm just going to show you a couple of the documents. You know, the Freedom of Information Act, as we have it, is in a sense it's an accident of history. You know, during the 1950s and 60s and earlier, when these classified documents were originated, the authors of the document, they had, I think, no expectation ever that their documents would be read one day. What happened was Vietnam and Watergate happened, and this the United States was in a unique historical mood. And in 1974, it resulted in the strengthening of the Freedom of Information Act so that citizens could petition their government for information on a whole array of topics related to the public interest. And as a result of that, thousands of pages of documents relating to UFOs came out, really during the late 70s and into the 80s. And then since then, FOIA has had its ups and downs. In 1982, there was an executive order in the Reagan years to severely undercut the ease with which and the expense, make it much more expensive for citizens to get FOIA documents. And it's had a little, there's been ups and downs ever since. But we've got really the golden era of FOIA was the late 70s. And these are just a few documents that I clipped. I'll just read them if you can't see them here. So from 1947, famous quote from General Nathan Twining, head of Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, later Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, describing these objects from military reports as circular or elliptical in shape, flat on bottom and domed on top. In 1947, that's rather interesting. Like, what is going to be flat on the bottom and domed on the top? Seen by military pilots, Twining described other things in his memo to another general at that time. Evasive maneuvers when sighted, silent or nearly silent, and so forth. So this is important. And, you know, keeping in mind that in 1947, the U.S. government was telling the public, there's nothing to this, it's hoaxes, misidentification, and so forth. No, not in the classified world, that's not true. Another document from 1949 describing, oh yes, Atomic Energy Commission, Air Force Special Weapons something, Fourth Army local commanders perturbed by implications of the phenomena. Perturbed by the implications of what they were encountering. Sure, they would be, because these were objects that were unidentified, unidentifiable, invading sensitive airspace. Local commanders did not know what to do, and that's in this particular document from January 49. Another one, an FBI document from late January 49, stating, the matter known as flying discs, flying saucers, balls of fire, etc., is considered top secret by intelligence officers of both the Army and the Air Forces. They were still using the old term of air forces back in at that time. So why would this matter be considered top secret? You know, why? It's worth asking. It's important. Anything that's top secret is important. Why were flying saucers top secret? Well, that particular document actually is many pages long, and it describes exactly why. Objects being tracked at thousands of miles per hour in 1949 and earlier. Maneuverability off the charts, all of this over sensitive installations. So that's why. And then here in 1950, how do I have this? The reports continue to set forth, unidentified objects in the airspace over Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which to date have not been explained. Yeah, Oak Ridge, one of our key areas for developing atomic technology in the 40s, the Manhattan Project, was just like Los Alamos, just like the Hanford Atomic Energy Commission in Washington, that site, were the scene of multiple unidentifiable UFOs. So right out of the gate, after World War II, these objects were seen over our nuclear installations. At that time, America's most advanced technology, right? Atomic nuclear technology. Very, very important. This is a snippet from a memo, top secret memo, by a Canadian scientist named Wilbur Smith, who had visited Washington, D.C., interviewed a top-level American defense scientist, and then Smith wrote a report back to his government, Canada, and just said, I made discreet inquiries through the Canadian embassy about UFOs. He says, the matter is considered the most highly classified subject in the United States government. The most highly. Higher than the hydrogen bomb in 1950. Flying saucers exist. Much, much more. And then these are just various docs from the early 1950s. Describing various types of objects. You know, operator said target moving at a speed several hundred miles per hour, higher than the maximum aided tracking ability of the radar sets. There's a, on the bottom here, or second from the bottom, is a CIA snippet, December of 52, written to the director of the CIA, who at that time was Walter Beadle Smith, written by his director of scientific intelligence. One of the, this is a quote, I think, that should be known by every school child in the U.S. and really in the world. And he just said, at this time, reports of incidents convince us that there is something going on that must have immediate attention. Then he goes on, sightings of unexplained objects at great altitudes and traveling at high speeds in the vicinity of major U.S. defense installations are of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. You know, you think about that. It's a sort of a somewhat bureaucratic, classified memo. So he's not going to say, boss, I think we're being invaded. But he might as well be. I mean, he's basically making a very, very explicit statement here. It's not natural phenomena. It's not anything that we know. And yet these objects are at incredible altitudes, incredible speeds over sensitive installations. Well, what else, you know? And at that same time, incidentally, American analysts were asking, is this the Soviets, the Russians, anyone else? Every time they asked, they came up empty. There were no answers. Then they would ask, is this something we're doing covertly? A fair question. You know, Americans stole their share of top secret Nazi scientists who were interested in some very, very advanced physics. True. And it's an argument that you can make, but the fact is, it's not an argument that satisfies. It doesn't explain the whole phenomenon. Not even close. Not even close. So, and on and on. I don't want to go over all of this. This is from a 1966 incident at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, where an object was seen at very, very high altitude, tracked by NORAD, North American Radar, descending. They send a strike team out to investigate. As they got to within, I think, even less than 10 miles, as much as 10 miles away, static disrupted their communications. They were not able to proceed any further, or did not proceed further. They watched the object take off where it was confirmed to be tracked by NORAD. And then, of course, the following year at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, a very well-known, famous incident where a glowing object, glowing red object, was seen by above-ground personnel. At the same time, 10 to 12 missiles below ground went offline. Bing, 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 one after the next. Lieutenant, later Captain Robert Salas, who's very well known in the UFO field, was there, described this in great detail, and so that happened. In the aftermath of that, Boeing, which was involved in the manufacture of these missiles, did a detailed analysis of why they went offline. And there was no reason why these missiles should have gone offline. Each were separately hardwired. And yet they all kind of cascaded and went down separately. In 1975, there were another series of really awe-inspiring and incredible airspace violations, mostly along the U.S.-Canadian border, but not all of them. There's some a little farther south, of objects they haven't been explained to this day. Long story short. So that's just some of the documents. There's much, much more. I like going back over some of these classic documents because, you know, when you start going into the detailed reports, you ask yourself, well, what technology did we have that could have done this? You know, if you were to see a black triangle over your head today, you might think, wow, well, we've got some very advanced technology maybe in the black budget world. That's worth inquiring into, of course. But in the 1950s, it's a little harder, in my view, to make that jump and ask yourself, what are these objects that some of the reports had them zigzagging and instant acceleration and so forth? So what I guess I would just say on the basis of that very small snippet of documentation, and again, there's much more, is that someone's here. Someone is here. I speculate all the time on who or what that someone is, and we can get into that, but someone is here that's not us. It's not this civilization that we know about. It is, you know, some fundamental facts. Someone's here. Our government authorities deny it. They continue to deny it this day. Even following the revelations in the New York Times last December when they talked about a UFO program, that's not the same as a disclosure. It's not an admission that someone else is here. Maybe they're inching along toward that, but it's not an admission. These someones, these somethings have technology that's not just radically advanced, but has to represent an infrastructure and is incredibly valuable, probably by our standards, incredibly expensive. Just worth keeping in mind. And it's all kept secret from us. So I often think of it as, I remember I was in Berlin when the wall came down in 1989. It was a great time in my life, and there were political cartoons I used to read. And, you know, after the Berlin Wall came down, if you recall, a lot of the Eastern European countries just started to, all the communist governments. And the last one to go was Romania under Nicolae Ceausescu and his wife Elena. And in the days leading up to that, I remembered reading a political cartoon. I would love to see it again. And it was a cartoon of a man sitting in a chair, strapped to the chair, blindfolded. All around him are people celebrating and being free. But he's strapped in a chair, blindfolded, and he was Romania. And that, I feel like, that's us in our own way. So we're like the guy in the chair strapped blindfolded while there's a whole infrastructure, as I now conceive it, that is going on beyond our little circumscribed fence or beyond our blindfold. So it's not simply UFO encounters, which are well documented, but there have been, I am fully convinced, crash retrievals. That's a much younger me, darker hair, looking a little more clean cut, with Dr. Edgar Mitchell back in, that was 2004 in Roswell, when I first met him in person. You know, at that conference, right after that photograph was taken, I went into a back room with him where we just chatted one-on-one, and he said to me that he had explicit knowledge of programs in the deeply classified world to study alien technology and alien bodies. Now, Edgar Mitchell was on Apollo 14. He was a PhD and a brilliant man, and a man in his, absolutely in his right mind. Absolutely. He said he had spoken to two individuals. And when you're a moonwalking astronaut, who's not going to want to be your buddy? I mean, Edgar Mitchell could have spoken to anyone, really. And he had two, he said to me, ultra-high-level connections that confirmed this reality to him. I have myself gotten such confirmation from another scientist who had almost as good connections as Dr. Mitchell, who explicitly said alien technology and at least one body that he personally knew about. And then there are others within that world who talk just like this, but they do it quietly. Mitchell, for the record, actually did speak publicly about that for a period of time in the late 90s, up to around, this was 2004. He talked up until 05, 06, I believe, and then he kind of backed away, stopped talking about the phenomenon and that level of explicitness. And he would just go back and say, you know, I know that there's life out there. He walked away, stepped back from that statement, but he made it a number of times, and he made it to me explicitly. The second bullet point is worth pointing out. There was another scientist I spoke to who has a great deal of knowledge of this program and just said to me, not quite offhandedly, but in passing, that A, the program is very expensive. B, the security for maintaining the program was 7 to 8 times more expensive than the scientific research and development. I maybe I should have pressed him. I didn't press him. Maybe I can still. Like, it's more than guys with M16s, I assume. It's got to be underground facilities and maybe old bribery money and who knows what else to keep the thing quiet. That same scientist said to me that it was his knowledge that every 5 years or so, the subject of disclosure, however you want to phrase it, would come up at the highest levels. And that he, on one occasion, was part of a subcommittee to discuss the implications of such disclosure. And despite the fact that he wasn't a lawyer, he was on a legal committee. I don't know why. He said their conclusion was that this was impossible, and one of the reasons was simply lawsuits. Simple lawsuits. Like, let's say I'm a defense contractor and you're a defense contractor and I have knowledge of this phenomenon. Therefore, I have an inside track on technology and scientific knowledge and you don't. You could sue for a breach of fair business practices, right? And so this, now, that's just one mundane possibility. And I think just from that, and then there's so many other implications. But according to him anyway, this is a subject that comes up, and every time it comes up, it gets batted down. So crash retrieval is a little more on crash retrieval. So this man was named Leonard Stringfield, and he was one of the more important UFO researchers in history. He wrote this book in the late 70s called Situation Red, in which he started to talk about crash retrieval stories that came to him. Keeping in mind, you know, in the late 70s, this is before the Roswell story came out. No one knew about Roswell. It had come out in 1947 and then was buried and forgotten for decades. And UFO researchers, I can tell you, you know, dismissed stories of crash retrievals. They said, that's crazy. You're talking crazy talk. That can't be the case. Encounters with extraterrestrials. That's nuts. And so, but these stories circulated. So Stringfield just collected them. And he wrote this book, and that opened the floodgates for many, many more people talking and coming to him. He collected more than 50, probably closer to 100 specific accounts from various people. And I'm just going to run a very few by you here. Some of these were spouses of deceased military people. You know, a guy tells his wife about something that happened to him, and then he dies. Some of them were living individuals who had the direct experiences. So a combination of these. Like one, I remember explicitly, the wife of her widow spoke to Stringfield and said her husband had once told her of guarding 9 alien bodies at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1966, 4 feet tall. He was told that there were 30 bodies at the base in total. And told that there was a craft at the base. And by the way, the idea of a craft at Wright-Patterson, this has come from more than one witness. There was a lady named June Crane who had a book written about her. She was a secretary at Wright-Patt. There's audio recordings of her in her later years before she died of cancer. June Crane was a very, very sharp, meticulous lady for sure. She also talked about her knowledge of a craft that was held at Wright-Patt. This guy told his wife that at certain military bases, there were mobile units in constant ready state to recover crashed UFOs. A lot of others. There was one Stringfield found. You've all probably heard of the alien autopsy video that Fox played like over 20 years ago. And people have argued, is it real, is it fake? Well, one thing I can say is that stories of alien autopsies, that's old. Like, that goes through the 1950s and 60s. There are a number of these that came up. Stringfield came up, came across one. I must have it in here. Fort Monmouth, yeah. So a radar specialist is at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey in 1953. A long time ago. And he said, you know, it's crazy. When I was there, I was once brought into a military theater. They gave me no briefing on this whatsoever. They just brought me and a few other people in, and we were shown a film of a crashed UFO and a tent where there was a dead alien body in it. It was the craziest thing. The film ends, the lights go on, we're escorted out. No one explains a thing to us. 2 weeks later, an intelligence officer on the base comes up to me and says, that film you saw, forget it, it was a hoax. And he said, I always wondered what that was. I've wondered, too. My theory, it's only a theory, is that if you're running a UFO crash retrieval operation and you need good people to work your program, you've got to scout out, and you've got to, like, you get candidates. And I'm guessing this guy failed the test for whatever reason. Maybe he talked to someone. Maybe he didn't react in the exactly right way. Who knows? But anyway, that was his story. Stringfield collected a lot of these. Lots of them, and put them together in a series of monographs. And then, of course, Stanton Friedman, a few years later, encountered retired Colonel Jesse Marcel of the Roswell crash and did the research and put that out there. And so by the 1980s, people were starting to research crash retrievals in much more. But it's more than just crash retrievals. We've got some very, very good sources that go beyond crash retrievals. So this journalist is named James Goodall. In the 1980s and 90s, he was going full guns over near Area 51 and Groom Lake facility, Groom Dry Lake. He's an aviation journalist. Not really a UFO guy per se, although I think he became very interested in UFOs. Wrote for all the type. He wrote for Jane's Defense, Aviation Week, Space Technology, high-level aviation publications. Did a lot of interviews during the 80s and 90s and cultivated certain people from the inside. One was a sergeant, I think a non-commissioned officer with over a decade at Area 51. And Goodall just says, so do you believe in UFOs? The guy says, absolutely, positively they exist. Goodall says, can you expand? The guy says, no. He gets another person around 1985 who says, look, we have things in the Nevada desert that would make George Lucas envious. So Star Wars. And in fact, he said, better than Star Trek, better than Star Wars or anything you see in the movies. This is 1985 or 86. So what's that all about? Goodall says, well, can you expand? The guy says, no. Goodall had his own conclusions. He says there are multiple black technologies, black projects coming out of Groom Lake beyond the B-2 stealth bomber, which was known about. So there you go. Then there's the story of the alien reproduction vehicle. I think this is very significant when we're getting into even the cost of secrecy. So the story is, in November of 1988, just as Catherine was getting ready to join the new presidential administration, there was an air show in California. Aviation writer Mark McCandlish, some of you I'm sure you know who Mark McCandlish is, was asked to go to this air show. And he couldn't at the last minute. He had a writing deadline, a publishing deadline. So he was going to go with his friend Brad Sorensen, who is an executive in the aerospace industry. Sorensen takes someone else with him, said to be a high-level defense official, very high-level. The defense official says they're there, and he says, I'm going to take you to the real air show, buddy. And they get into a helicopter, and they go off to Lockheed's facility, Hellendale facility, to a place called the Big Hangar. Guarded with a lot of guns. The official says, just don't say anything, I'll get you in. So they get in, and Sorensen, he was interviewed by many, many people. I've not spoken to him, but I know a lot of the people who did interview him. He said, I was totally amped up. I was like alert, super alert, hyper alert, noticed everything. So there was a curtain dividing the hangar. On one side of the curtain were very, very sophisticated aircraft that had lost bids for defense contracts, but they were still noteworthy. On the other side, he goes to the other side, and there were three hovering objects. They were flying saucers, small, medium, and large. They looked like that. Sorensen was able to look in one, gave the specs to McCandlish, who put that illustration together. And there was a four-star general at a podium giving a lecture on them, referring to them as the alien reproduction vehicles. It's 1988, describing them as having traversed the solar system by then. I mean, does one believe such a story or not? Well, the people who interviewed Sorensen believe him. This I know. Sorensen said, you know, I looked at it, and he said, my sense was that they'd been run around because they were all dented up and beat. They looked like they'd been used. So for what it's worth, that's his story. And by the way, the general had said that these objects run on the vacuum. Now, this was 1 year before the first article on zero-point energy was published by Dr. Harold Puthoff, Hal Puthoff, who wrote, I believe, the first article on zero-point energy, often known as the vacuum. So a little aside, I'm going to come to Bob Lazar here, I believe. Yeah. So if you don't know who Bob Lazar is, Lazar is the guy who really made Area 51 famous. 1989, 1990. He seems to have had a job, I'm quite sure this is true, at south of Area 51, what was known as S4, Section 4, where he saw, he said, perfect flying saucer with a very, very small cabin that a human being was not designed for a normal-sized human being, too small. Lazar went to S4 six times, talked about it. His briefing on it, documents he read, indicated to him that the object traveled on the basis of an element known as element 115, an isotope of that created enough power to manipulate the space-time around the object to create its own artificial gravity. And so element 115. It's quite possible, in my opinion, that Lazar, I mean, maybe he was given genuine information, but maybe he wasn't. Let's say Sorensen's story is the true one, that these objects run on the vacuum, on zero-point energy. So if you guys are building a flying saucer using zero-point energy, but these guys want to build their own flying saucer, let's say they're Russians, and you don't want them to know what your source of energy is, maybe you would float this story out there, that it takes element 115, jokingly referred to as unobtainium because it's so difficult to find and get, and according to what Lazar was told, was bequeathed by the extraterrestrials. Like, we didn't have to manufacture that isotope. Funny, since that time, you hear news reports that we've been able to manufacture 115, but with a half-life of like a couple of seconds, so still not very useful. So this group might think, oh my goodness, 115, forget it, we can't do that, let's just give up. So the idea being that Lazar is truthful, but was fed information that was not truthful. Just a thought. In any case, the journalist George Knapp, who brought Lazar out into the public domain, and many others that he interviewed, actually more than 20, who he has said have corroborated various aspects of Bob Lazar's story. But none of them were willing to go publicly. A number of them were really threatened, according to Knapp. This object is an interesting one. This made it to the TV show Hard Copy in the 1990s. It's known as the Nellis UFO from Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada. It was filmed and then leaked. So apparently it was filmed by Air Force or some other military individuals. And you hear them on audio, by the way, saying, what is that? Is that a helicopter? What is that? It was an object that, because of the readouts, you can't see it on this screen, but you can find this on YouTube, and there's many analyses of this that you can read. You can get the altitude and azimuth and the position of this so you can calculate its speed, which a number of analysts have done. So within just a few short couple of minutes, it speed ranged from as slow as 15 miles per hour to over 500. So a very, very nice range of speed, including right-angle turns at 140 miles per hour. It also seemed to change shape. It's very, very unusual. So the question is, who's making that thing? I think the consensus is that we're making it. That's something that we're doing. But again, we don't know. if it is something we're making, that's just more evidence of a human-based replication program. This fellow is Gary McKinnon. I correspond with Gary. He's a very, very good guy. For many years, you may have known, he was, you know, the U.S. government wanted to extradite him from the U.K. and possibly throw him into Guantanamo Bay. It's certainly what it seemed to be. McKinnon in the 90s was obsessed with UFOs and would go to U.S. defense sites looking for evidence. And one day, in 2000, he's at the U.S. Space Command website, and somehow he gets into a place where you're not supposed to go, and he gets information on something that's known as Solar Warden, a space program, with a list of officers' names he found under the heading Non-Terrestrial Officers, and a list of fleet-to-fleet transfers that include lists of ship names that are not in anywhere in the U.S. naval inventory. And he couldn't remember the names. He was arrested in 2002, and for many years, close to a decade, the U.S. government wanted to bring Gary McKinnon back. He became something of a cause celeb in the U.K., and they were able to prevent the extradition from happening. Very interesting case. What one little sidelight of Gary McKinnon is, in the early years when he was making the news, the UFO connection was very prominently discussed in the media. As the years went by, the UFO connection just went away. It was like it never happened. He was just referred to as a defense hacker. But the fact was, he was explicitly looking for UFO data, found what he believes was a UFO-related program, and that's why the U.S. government was after him. They called him the greatest hacker in history, which is definitely not accurate in the least. One thing I'll just mention here. This is a quote from Ronald Reagan from his diary in 1985 when he was president, just saying, had lunch with five top space scientists. It was fascinating. I learned that our shuttle capacity is such that we could orbit 300 people. So, first of all, the U.S. never officially orbited 300 people in space at any given time. But the capacity was there. So what were they doing? Just have to wonder. Were there other elements? One thing that you have to know about a secret space program, even if you eliminate all exotic tech from the equation, the United States can only dominate the world by dominating space as a platform of operations. Like, it's not possible. You can't have those bombs with pinpoint accuracy take out the enemy targets unless you control space as your theater of operations. And so for the United States military, space is non-negotiable. Like, they must control space. And so there's going to be a very, very major classified component in space no matter what. No matter what. That's going to be up there. I know a lady, and she lives in Arkansas. She's got, she lives near an air base and sees a lot of crazy aerial phenomena that's not supposed to be there. She's got Generation 3 night vision, so she's got good quality night vision glasses. And I've talked with her. This was an email she wrote to me. She says, there are all kinds of craft up there. Military drones, drone triangles, even a huge rectangular craft that she saw in daylight. She writes, I have seen these craft cloak. I saw one cloak over my house at treetop level, and I tell you, it could not be seen at all, and it was only about 50 yards away. I've also seen these drones from less than 30 feet, and there is no movement, no vibration, nothing. They look as though they are glued to the sky. She's interesting because she went through... she's a really good FOIA researcher now. So because she became interested in these drones, she became very, very proficient at filing Freedom of Information Act requests on drone technology and has got a stack of information on military drone technology. She's probably one of the most knowledgeable people in the United States on drone technology. So what I would say, this is just a basic summation is, what does it look like? I always try to distinguish what I know is true, and what I think things look like. It's both valid, it's valid to talk about both, but I like to distinguish. So what it looks like, there's a major effort going on to conceal the UFO reality and to replicate that technology. That's important. Obvious to see why it would be important. It's incredibly valuable. I mean, just imagine we're part of the black budget research and development community, and we gain access to something that we have to study. piece of alien tech or some kind of field propulsion technology or something, you know, that allows you to have anti-gravity or a new form of energy that would make fossil fuels redundant. So that would be very important, would it not? And we would be asked to study that. And what if we were to come up with some solutions, like we were to come up with a form of energy that would supersede oil and natural gas and so forth? Well, that would change the world, which you would think would be a great thing to do, but maybe our bosses would say no, because there's a lot of interests that want to maintain oil and natural gas, like the United States, for example, which maintains control over the world through control over the distinct locations of oil and natural gas. So you'd say, well, no, we're not going to let this out to the rest of the world, but we're going to keep studying it. We're going to develop our own technology, and we're going to race vastly far ahead of the rest of the world. We'll classify the tech. We'll create a global infrastructure, by the way, with intellectual property rights. So if some genius in India or any other part of the world comes up with it, we'll prevent them from developing it because we've globalized intellectual property rights, and they can't do it. That's what we'll do. And meanwhile, maybe we'll develop our own flying saucer tech and go off world and have our own adventures. Sounds crazy, but it's actually, this is what I think is the case. I think it's exactly the case. Exactly the case. So one of the key points I want to make here is that all of this is expensive to do these types of programs. It's not free. It's definitely not free. We think of, you know, we have a military budget of over, U.S., of over $700 billion, which by itself is greater than the next, I think, six or seven nations combined, including China and Russia and the UK and Saudi Arabia. And it's vastly more than any other nation could bring to bear. But even this, like, it's one thing to create a F-18A Super Hornet. That's expensive and that's really awesome. But this stuff, this is beyond. How much does it cost? Good question, but a lot. It can't openly come from tax dollars. Like, you know, it may come from tax dollars in one form or another, but it's not going to be known. They can't just lay it out there saying, yeah, we got our flying saucers in this little line item here. That's not going to happen. The money's got to come from different sources. And it's really handy, isn't it, to have a source of income where you don't have to have little, you know, receipts and vouchers and things like that. Slush funds are really handy. Narco money is handy. Securities fraud money is super handy. Who knows where they're getting it from? There's a big black hole at the center of our global financial system. Some of it's going into these programs, I'm convinced. How much, I don't know. So the program requires corruption of the system for it to operate. It can't operate any other way. It requires what we call a black budget, a budget that's black so that you can't see it. You don't know what it is. And it requires corruption of the system. It has to, because we have a system where we like to think it's open and democratic and people are sovereign. Well, it's not quite, is it? So in order to make this work, you have to siphon people's monies out, and they're not just going to give you the money willingly. So you have to find a way to do it. You have to corrupt the system at every level, at every level. How do you create the money? Well, I think many of you in this room have better ideas on how to do that than I would. It's a question for creative accountants, for bringing that money into that system worth thinking about. The way that I look at this phenomenon now is that, as I hinted earlier in this talk, is that two paths have converged. And this is a graphic that I just put together. I thought, this works. So you have the UFO reality, which I've just been talking about, really, that has deeply affected our civilization. But, you know, our civilization's on its own path, independent to a large extent of the UFO phenomenon. And so I want to talk about that trajectory and then how the two have worked together and where that is going to be taking us moving forward. So one thing that I tell a lot of my colleagues who are in the alternative research field, but they don't do UFOs. They'll research 9/11, they'll research underground bases, they'll research chemtrails, whatever, but they run away from UFOs, is this. If you don't really understand the UFO phenomenon, you are missing a critical part of what makes up our world. Maybe the key part, but certainly a key part. And it's hard sometimes to explain this to such researchers because they've gone through their whole life and there's more than enough for them to research with what they do. So it's easy for them to think, well, this UFO stuff, that's for fun and games, that's a joke. What's the funny thing is that I tell these people, you're willing to disbelieve your government on every single thing except UFOs? Like you're going to believe them on that? Think about that. So you're not going to believe them on 9/11. You're not going to believe them on chemtrails. You're not going to believe them on fraud in the government. But you're just going to believe them when they talk to you about UFOs and have lied for the last 70 plus years. You're just going to. So maybe rethink that philosophy. All right? Maybe just consider that you're being played on that just like they try to play everyone else on every other subject. So the UFO subject isn't necessarily the creator of our black budget infrastructure, but it is absolutely one of the key drivers right from the beginning of the black budget culture that has now permeated so much of the world. By necessity, if you're Harry Truman and you're being told that this is a phenomenon, you're just going to tell the world? No, you're not, because it's too disruptive, and you yourself don't really know what the implications are. So you're going to create a team. You're going to say, let's figure this out. You're going to study the tech. You're going to study how bad public panic will be. You're going to control the media, please. Keep them in line. The academic community. And we'll revisit this every so often. And then, of course, the secrecy just develops its own life, its own profit, its own reason to be, and necessitates an end run around legal formal structures of power and the stuff that we're taught in our civics class. That's supposed to be the case. None of that applies with UFOs. One of the things about the UFO reality, absolutely confirmable, is that the military people who are studying this want to weaponize the technology. And I know this. There's a document, a UK document from 1999 known as the Condine Report. Some of you may have heard of it. In that report, it's 400 pages. Some of it's dry as dust, but some of it's fascinating. They discuss UAP, that is UFOs, unidentified aerial phenomena, unexplained aerial phenomena. The UK military is clearly taking it seriously in this document. They discuss several cases, including the famous Rendlesham case of 1980, and they talk about the need, the utility of weaponizing the technology of these things. It's obvious. They're military people. This is how they think. They want to weaponize this. So that's a big part of the classified effort. Any breakthroughs that they have to conceal and let out by degrees as is useful for them or as is necessary for them, creating what I've often called a breakaway civilization. It's not that hard to understand. Think of the classified world with its own technology, its own classified reality that it is allowed to work with, but the rest of the outside world cannot. One breakthrough, science works. You know, if you have a breakthrough, that leads to other breakthroughs and others. But if those people are prevented from the first breakthrough, they're going to have a really hard time going down the road that we're going. And we may just go so far ahead of them that we may, in fairness, be credited as having a separate civilization, one that has broken away from them with a different cosmology, a different understanding of the fundamental natures of reality. Yes, I think that's the case in part of that classified world that studies this phenomenon. And that includes a secret space program. A, it would have to logically, but B, there are enough leaks, hints, indications that I think, yes, this is true. I mean, no, you don't get a confirmed statement out of Washington. Okay, at least the one that we would like to get. But all signs point to yes. So and I've said this before, there's a substantial secret infrastructure in this world. It's off limits to you and me, but it's there. Catherine has said it's like it's an open financial system. It's not closed. We're taught that it's closed. Everything's contained, but it's open. Something's leaking out, siphoning out. That's what it is. So this is a graphic I developed a little while ago. I kind of like it, so I think you can see it. It's of concentric circles. In the center of the circle is the reality that we are encouraged to live within. It's the brightest part of that circle. I call it mass reality. Mass reality is like Kim Kardashian and the stupid Yahoo News feeds. It's all about celebrities and all this nonsense. It's the reality that, you know, football and Dancing with the Stars and all the other entertainment that's basically designed to suck the brain cells right out of your head. Mass reality. We're all brought into it. And if we're smart, we find a way to kind of push it out. And then when you go to the university, I remember going and 1980. I was a freshman at a little university in New York State called Alfred University, and I learned that, wow, there's a much more sophisticated way of looking at reality. I remember thinking, Noam Chomsky, I'm way out there. I've just really figured it all out now. And so academic reality, and you get this with a lot of the professors, of course. A lot of great people in academia, don't get me wrong, but so many are just so unbelievably arrogant and pompous and so self-satisfied. And they're like, we understand how it works. We're so far beyond mass reality with the, you know, these little minds. We understand how the world really works. Well, no, sorry, you don't. And I know this because like in the field of history, which I know best, historians are not able, of course, to write histories based on classified literature by definition. They can't get to it. I remember back in the 80s, I was trying to get books on the CIA. In all of the University of Rochester library, a great academic library, there was like a small handful of books on the CIA. I mean, you could probably carry them out in one arm at that time. There's probably more now, but you know, when you're really, and a lot of those books were just self-congratulatory, I mean, hagiographies of the people there. So nothing really, and so why is that? It's that because, well, if it's classified, you're not going to know about it. That's the whole point of spycraft. Like, what they do is off limits. And academicians understand this intellectually, but I really believe they forget. So they start putting their histories together based on what's available, and they forget, like, there's this whole classified world out there, and it's just like it never existed. Well, it does exist. It's significant, it's substantial, and it's concealed from us for a reason. So, and that's the classified reality. So they have a much, and you notice each circle gets a little darker because it's a little harder to see it, right? And then beyond the classified world is what I call the breakaway reality. That's the part of the classified world that deals with this reality that I've been talking about, this UFOs, extraterrestrial, whatever it is. That's very, like, specialized need to know, you know? And they know much, much more. But even they, I am sure, do not have access to whatever it is this reality is that these other beings have, whoever they are, whatever they are. So it's degrees of darker and darker from us. So let me just switch gears completely now to what I call our all-too-human hierarchy. That's J.P. Morgan. This is the other road that now is intersecting. This is a human hierarchy. It occurred to me that, you know, our civilization had a really awesome period for a couple of centuries, about 200 years. Let's call it the Industrial Revolution and the immediate aftermath, in which the people were allowed, to have a middle class. That's because of a historical anomaly, in which the people were permitted by various degrees to be rather unleashed in the pursuit of free enterprise, in the pursuit of, like, you following your dream to make your money and your living as you saw fit. That's free enterprise. You are free to do that. And that's an amazing thing, and never really existed, as far as we can tell, in all of human history. It's a powerful tool for creating wealth and for unleashing creativity in all kinds of ways. I'm a real believer in that for the people, and I'm sure probably all of you are. The point is that I think people were allowed to be unleashed because those elites above us who have always, for all time, always wanted to live like gods, that's how they see themselves. Whether it's the pharaohs of ancient Egypt or barons of the 11th century or any other, they're the gods and they look down on the little people and that's the way it is. But they realized for several hundred years that letting the little people engage in free enterprise economic pursuits was a great thing for them too. It made the world wealthier. It made their nation more powerful. I remember reading recently about Peter the Great, the Tsar of Russia. He was an amazing guy. He goes in disguise through Europe, Tsar of Russia, to learn the ways of Western Europe and to bring them back to Russia, to make Russia wealthier and more powerful. That's how it used to be, right? You wanted your nation to be powerful. You wanted your nation to be well-educated. And it benefited all of us. What I will suggest to you is that we may be passing that era in which people are actually necessary or useful. And I will explain now why I think the elites may feel that they no longer need us to the extent that we were once needed. There's computing hardware. You've all heard of Moore's Law, the kind of doubling of capacity of leading-edge computing technology every couple of years. Well, it's more than hardware. It's total computing capability. And the fact is, computing power is vastly, vastly, vastly beyond anything. We all know this, even of a couple of years ago. Then you got the future of artificial intelligence, which some people think UFOs are strange. Read a few books on the future of AI, and then come back to me and tell me how strange UFOs are. You have no idea if you haven't read. People like Ray Kurzweil talking about a future of godlike intelligence by machines. Well, I don't know if they really will have godlike intelligence, but most AI researchers, or many, I guess I should say, fully believe that your laptop in 20 years or less will have, or at least seem to have, advanced consciousness. It'll tell you that it is. Whether you believe it or not is your choice, but it's going to seem like it, along with having an IQ of, 500 or 1,000 or whatever. So that's down the road. And whatever that consciousness is almost irrelevant to me. It's that it is recreating our world and the leading edge of intelligence radically beyond anything that we have right now. Then you've go. Oh, I just accidentally skipped over, my mistake. Quantum computing. I have a hard time even wrapping my brain around what quantum computing really does, but I do know it's radical advance in computing capabilities and code breaking and much more. Then I talked with a young genius on an airplane once who was telling me about molecular computing. I'm like, what's that? And he's like, oh yeah, that's massively important. So I need to look into that. Nanotech. Robotics, 3D printing and scanning, gene editing, CRISPR technology, brain mapping. Think about how these technologies will sort of work with each other. In other words, would it be possible using advanced nanotech, AI, and CRISPR technology and super advanced 3D printing that can, in addition to doing plastics, maybe do integrated circuits next generation? Would it be possible to create a kind of a cybernetic being of some sort? Look, we've got hospitals right now talking about 3D printing replacement livers. I don't know if they're doing it yet, but they believe they can do it. So we're moving into a very, very strange world where a lot of these technologies are coming online. Catherine was just talking to me. She says the people upstairs are talking about creating either, human-like robots or robot-like humans? Is that how you put it?
They're prototyping robotic humans.
Yes.
And human-like robotics and seeing which they prefer for what function.
Which is best? Good old-fashioned, unenhanced Homo sapiens, though, is going out the window as far as they're concerned. And then, world of implants for greater abilities, population profiling, think Minority Report. It's already happening, really, based on your web searches and so much more. And they're listening to you. And, the fact is that they can compile more information about you than you may even know about yourself in many ways. And use it against you, of course. And keeping you from even having access to that data. Facial voice recognition, it's going to be ubiquitous if it isn't already. So in other words, think you're going to hide from the system? No, you're not going to hide from the system. They'll hear your voice anywhere. They'll identify your voice wherever you are. They'll know it's you. Same with your face, your profile, cameras everywhere. And then think with insect drone technology, if it's not here yet, it's going to be here with little cameras. They'll get you wherever you go. Doesn't matter anymore. They've got you. Mind-reading technologies. You can read these in current science news stories every now and then. Ways of reading what you're thinking. Like, they can do it. Now, right at this point, last I read is you have to have your head connected with little electrodes or whatever. And if you do that, they'll know what parts of your brain are firing up. They'll know what you're thinking about, even if they don't have the specifics. But there are technologies now to decode, I'm not joking, to decode your brain patterns to specific words. Now, how good are they at it? Don't know. But I read an article about this. And if it's mainstream, you got to wonder where they're actually at in the classified world. Reading your mind. And, it's only a matter of time before they don't need the physical wires and electrodes if they're already there. So they don't need us. They don't need us for so much. In the old days, you needed a viable population of smart people, creative people with initiative. to create this infrastructure that would make their world more interesting and wealthier and better. But now we got almost 8 billion people in this world. How many of us do they really need? And when you get their virtual genius assistants, their own little, maybe a small elite group of human tech experts in whatever fields, they don't need a whole population for that at all. So in short, what I would say is they don't need us organized around free labor anymore. They don't need us organized on principles of free enterprise or ingenuity or creativity. There's a thing coming. It's called the Robopocalypse, and it's not the Terminator coming to kill you. He's just coming to take your job away. And there's a lot of good writing on this phenomenon from tech people and economists, not from fringe people like me. So that's what it is. You know, if these elites have, if they have a few basic things, if they have genetic superiority, which they absolutely want, if they have longer lifespans, better health for them and their children, and basically immortality, they're cool. They're good because they'll have all the other tech that they want, you know? And that's really what they're about to get. You know, you talk about CRISPR technology and all these crazy Frankenstein-like AI people who think, oh, yes, the world's going to be wonderful. We'll have immortality. Thanks, Ray Kurzweil, but I beg to differ. Immortality for whom? Well, if you can pony up the money, I suppose you can get it. But for most people, won't be the case. What we're moving toward is a biological-based caste system. That's really what we're moving toward. Now, maybe they'll eliminate the whole bottom caste altogether and replace them with robots. I don't know, but that's what we're moving toward. So this is our class system. I've concluded this a long time ago. 4 classes of people in this world when you look at wealth. All right? So the top class, that little tiny peak, that's the owner class. They own everything. In a room of 100 people, if there's $100 in that room, one guy owns almost 50 of those dollars at the very least. That's our world. Owns half the money in the world. The next guy after him owns another $9, $10. That's the manager class. So they have a very strong interest, right, in maintaining this system. In that room, it's a room with a political system, an economy, financial system, education system, laws. Who's going to be in the best position to manipulate them for his own benefit? That's a question that answers itself. And then you have the worker bees, who may have a couple of pennies here and there to play around with. They keep the system running. George Carlin put it very well in one of his later lecture routines. He says, you know, they're smart enough to do all the paperwork and get the job done and make society keep going, but they're still dumb enough to keep doing it. And that's the worker bees. You know, they're the people who make it happen. And then at the bottom, in an ever-growing amount of the population, are what I call the expendables. They don't have job skills. What are they going to do? You know? Retail, McDonald's can't take them all. It's just not going to happen. So they don't have literacy. They don't have numeracy. They could literally drop dead, and it wouldn't affect those people at the top, except their existence is useful because it keeps the worker bees on edge. And, you know, they're fighting each other. And that's our system. That's it. 4 classes, that's it. That's how it works. So the goals of this power elite, look, they're recreating the world right now. And it's been ramped up since the end of the Cold War, since globalization. They're going full gun now, pedal to the metal. They're creating a new system of royalty, is really what it is. Catherine said the other day, they believe in slavery. Right? They're the royalty. They want most of us to work for them for the rest of all time. And they're working on it. They'll get it. If no one stops them, they're absolutely going to do it. They're creating their own breakaway legal structure, breakaway financial structure. Catherine wrote an essay years ago called The Myth of the Rule of Law. Law doesn't apply to them. You know, all the regular rules don't apply to them. They want to end nations altogether, and they're ending that as well. So they're creating a global system with total financial control over people, always, forever. I should add a total bureaucratized control over the system, legal system, system of laws that basically are ever more constrictive than they've ever been. That involves mind control, and I'll get into that. And to create this new paradigm. 9/11 was really the centerpiece of that new paradigm. It was the moment in which they said to you, those rights you thought you have, yeah, just forget that. Those are gone now. You know, back in the old days, the before times don't exist anymore. And by the way, in the United States, and I'm sure in Australia, about 25% of the population now is under the age of 18. They never knew the before time. It's all post 9/11 for them. They've grown up in the world of Facebook, social media, privacy. Who cares? They don't care about privacy. They've been acculturated not to care. And they've given it up. It's all gone. Say goodbye to that world. So they're creating a new paradigm. So this is one slide that I've retained from an earlier lecture. I guess it's sort of relevant. I created it to describe how I thought UFO secrecy worked internationally. But it's a good, just gives you a kind of a visual of how the system really works in terms of power politics. So at the top, you've got the banks, the transnational top 1% of the 1%. That's basically with their fingers over the marionettes controlling. And they work through, the United States is really their best tool. It's got the most powerful military by far. And so if you want to control those oil fields, or you want to control this banking system, or you want to keep that nation from damaging the petrodollar, well, you need the U.S. military to do your work for you, and you will use that military. That's the butt-kicking military in the world, that everyone, if you've got the money and the resources, you're going to use that military as your personal police force. And you'll work with the U.S. intelligence agencies to coordinate, I'll use that word, with other partners to enforce your rule over the rest of the world. So, you know, I read a brilliant article, analysis of the U.S.'s relationship to other partner nations. So there are levels of partnership. Like the U.K. is a top-level, top-tier partner. They're below the U.S., but they are a higher level. U.S., U.K. and Israel have certain high-level status. Other nations have lower-level status, like Poland has a lower-level status. Their job is to house American troops, and they get a couple of fringe benefits here and there. Lower-level nations like Greece are basically there to exist, to turn into an open-air prison and enslave the population and siphon money out of the population. And there's all these different levels of how you're supposed to exist. But anyway, that's the partnership. That's how it works. So now this was really inspired by Catherine's work in her excellent piece on Control 101. So I formulated this in my own mind. So how does the control work? So for me, I think one key way has to be financial control. How do they control us in this system from just getting a little too uppity and understanding that we're being robbed? Well, one method is financial control. So you take people's jobs away. You know, one of the things that I did for years before I wrote my UFO books was I wrote professional resumes. There's an interesting little sidelight. I have my own little office. People would come in out of work, and I would write a professional resume for it. Good ones, too. Did it for thousands of people, including a former mayor of my city and lots of other people. Make them look great. So, but one thing I learned is, like, I live in Rochester, New York, where I watched Eastman Kodak just go up in smoke, right, through the 90s. I saw a whole generation of people just lose their sense of hope, lose their sense of the future. People coming in age 55, 60, not knowing what to do because, like, their job of 30, 35 years is gone and they're just left out. The jobs are going away. First they went to Mexico, then they went to China. They're gone. And, you know, what do these people do? Well, they just get hooked on opioids and they watch TV. I don't know what they do. A lot of them, there's nothing for them. It's like a game of musical chairs when someone's just taking all the chairs out of the room. And the ones that remain are really kind of not that good, many of them. So by doing that, like, I remember talking with one guy who was working back in the 60s. He was a mold maker. And he said, you know, back then, I didn't need a resume. He said, I thought it was dishonorable to quit my job if I had found something else. Like, he said, I would quit my job, then look for another job. He said, and I never had a problem doing it. Because in the 60s, it was like the best building construction period since an industrial period since the building of the pyramids. You know, there was work everywhere. He said, you could quit high school, go off to California, do LSD for 2 years, live in a commune, come back, and get a job that could pay your mortgage. It's like, wow. That doesn't happen. Why? Because the jobs are gone. And in such a state of insecurity, people are not going. They're not going to take out to the streets and protest. You know, they're just happy to survive. And that's what we move towards. So by removing the jobs, you remove hope and you remove the will often to resist. As long as you don't go too far down. When people get too desperate, then the pitchforks and guns come out. But for right now, you just remove enough opportunity. You siphon enough hope out. You take the soul out of people. So you offshore the jobs. You automate the jobs. That's another way to do it. Of course, the robo-apocalypse. And then another way to take financial control away from people is you bureaucratize everything. I live in New York State. How can anyone start a business in New York State is beyond me. I have no idea how you can do it. Taxation, the regulations, through the roof. And it's really many states are like this. So they make it impossible for a person to go on their own to create their own destiny. You know, instead you have to work for Target. You got to work for a bank. You got to work for someone else. You can't work for yourself. It's really hard, let alone employ other people. Healthcare costs and all of that nonsense. It's impossible, virtually. And so on. So that's it, financial control. And they all do it in the name of making, you know, people safe and secure. It's always for that. Being fair, providing. But it makes it, the end result is that it makes it impossible for people to really survive on their own. I read these AI people. They all frighten me, every single one of them. And they're some of the leaders in talking about, we need a universal basic income in the future because there's not going to be enough jobs. The robots are going to take all the jobs. Got to give everyone their own income. I'm like, you're crazy. You know nothing about economics. If you think that that's going to work, please explain to me how a system is going to work by giving everyone free money and they're not doing anything. A, that's a problem. B, the real problem, that's good. Congratulations, guys. You just come up with a plan to make every single person dependent for the rest of all time on the state. Like, if the state's giving you your money, you have no independence at all. So it's a great way to create a completely, utterly servile, dependent population. So that's my thought. So financial control, then survey. Oh, the tree. They did this the last time I gave this very lecture. The tree guys. And the last time, Catherine, she got into it. She goes out there, marched out, and she was able to get them to stop eventually.
Maybe she just did it again.
I think you're right. So I'll keep going. So financial control, surveillance is another form of control, clearly. If you're surveilling the population 24/7 in every way, you're intimidating the population, and you're preventing people from acting as free actors, right? So they track your ISP, they track your browser, they track your email, all with government agencies. We all know this out in the open since Snowden. We've really known it much earlier than Edward Snowden, frankly. William Binney talked about this even before Snowden, Binney of the NSA, who designed a lot of the software. And we've known it even before Binney, if you've been paying attention. You know, I read a book back in 2002 by James Bamford, who wrote a book on the NSA called Body of Secrets. Bamford talked about satellites, geosynchronous satellites that were monitoring, he said, over 90,000 cell phone calls simultaneously in 2000. It's 20 years ago. That was then. So, I mean, the capability is just off the charts. And then they monitor you through social media, Facebook. Not just the government, but your employers or future employers. They all know what you're doing. It's a real problem for people, as you all know. And then there's the new technologies to track you. You know, all the apps, your heart rate, your physiology, your medical stuff on an app, or your location, obviously. Like, you're tracking your location constantly. Your financial records. How much do we think that all of this is just totally secure and not available to some prying agency? Well, it's all available. You know, and if you really don't know much about this, go watch a few videos and interviews with Edward Snowden. He's very, very astute. He talks about a lot of this stuff and makes it very obvious. No, it's all tracked, all of it, through your phone. And then there's, you know, public space video surveillance, facial recognition. I talked a little bit about that. That's pretty much in more and more public spaces around the world. voice tracking. I talked a little bit about that. So basically, all in the name of keeping you safe. Keeping you safe by tracking you 24/7. Remember, right after 9/11, there was a family in Florida that made the news. We're so happy. We've been chipped. And now we know we're safe because the government can always find us if anything ever happens to us. And this was plastered in much of the media as a really wonderful thing. You should consider getting yourself chipped. It'll keep you safer as well. I don't think that went over too well. That was a kind of a lead balloon. But the idea is to promote this idea of and now they're going to make chips sexy. You want to go to a nightclub, have a little chip on your finger rather than have yourself get carded. That's for losers. Get yourself chipped. It's cool. You know, I used to think microchips were the future, but I wonder now. There's probably going to be better ways. Microchips may not be necessary. Your cell phone basically is your microchip right now anyway, but there'll probably be something better and sleeker than even a microchip. I haven't figured out what that is. So that's surveillance. Then there's fear. Fear is a great way to control people. Now we're moving toward mind control a bit. So you've got, you know, a complete main integration between what we call mainstream media and the intelligence community. Now, I think most of you are probably on board with this, but if you're not, there's one word I have for you. It's called Mockingbird. And if you don't know what Mockingbird was, I'll tell you. Mockingbird was outed in the 1970s by the journalist Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame. And it was a CIA program. It was actually unearthed a couple of years earlier during the church committees of the intelligence investigations in the U.S. But anyway, Mockingbird was a program that the CIA did, had at least 400 U.S. journalists on the CIA payroll secretly to spin news, to create news, create fake news. We talk about fake news now, but they were creating it explicitly back then, primarily for purposes of regime change, as far as we know. And the fake stories would be like international creations, like if you want to regime change Iran in 1953 or Guatemala in 1954, you create stories of mass graves in Guatemala, for example, which happened, which were not true. And they come back to the U.S. and the public's like, oh, my God, we've got to stop this and we got to take out the government. Or Cuba in 1961. So that was Mockingbird. And then on top of that, in addition to the fake stories, was just total control of spin, editorial policy, censorship. You know, you create reality by omission. It's probably the most significant way to do it even today. You just omit, cleanse, and this is the reality that we are going to show you. It's the simplest way. Censorship, spin, false news. False flags. I'm writing a book right now on the history of false flags. I think it's the first ever analytical history of the phenomenon, and hopefully I'll get it done one day. And I did a show, I wrote and hosted a show on Gaia on false flags. Some of you, I think, have seen it. False flag is simply one of those little dastardly things that governments do, like blow up buildings and kill people, and then blame it on other guys like terrorists. And there's certainly a lot of... Thank you, Catherine. She's... All right. So that's a false flag. And there are many historically confirmed examples of false flags. Not just the German invasion of Poland in 1939, but that's one and lots of others. Some were outed and never did happen. Something that the Israelis did call the Lavrov Affair in 1954 was one example. And then Operation Northwoods, probably the most well-known of the false flags that didn't happen. Northwoods was... something that landed on Kennedy's desk in 1962 and was promoted by his Air Force Chief of Staff, who basically had this nifty idea of a couple of different possibilities that Northwoods entertained. So one was to pretend that the Cubans had hijacked a U.S. airliner and that they had shot down a U.S. commercial jet. All of which to justify a land invasion of Cuba. One of the Northwoods suggestions was actually literally to kill a certain number of Americans and blame it on the Cubans. So we're moving toward a kind of a 9/11 false flag scenario, and that's Northwoods. That's 40 years before 9/11. You have Northwoods. Kennedy says, no, this is not going to happen, sorry. and it didn't happen, and it was forgotten until James Bamford publicized Northwoods in 2002. So we know we got the documents, and it's real. So that's false flags, and that's a real major thing. And I'll talk about that later this week, of course, for you. But anyway, so the whole purpose of the fear aspect, it's that simple. Create insecurity in you. Create dependency on the state. They will protect you. Another way they control us is just by poisoning us, like physically poisoning our bodies. You got all the processed foods that are horrible for us. I mean, I often wonder, like, how could McDonald's function if they didn't just create poison food? Like, they have to do it. Like, it's the logistics. You know, you go to a McDonald's, whether it's in New York City or Paris or any other part of the world, and you expect your Big Mac to be a certain way, and you expect your fries to be a certain way. So I understand the difficulties of running a massive global food operation. I get it. But man, they do toxify us. And it's not just McDonald's. It's the whole processed food industry that creates foods that are so terrible for us. We all know this. Make us unhealthy and dull our minds. And then you got the whole pharmaceutical drug phenomenon. And, you know, it's bad enough they do it to people, but they do it to children, which to me is the most unconscionable thing of all. The Ritalin and the chemicals. And, you know, I mentioned this to the last group. I went through a brief period where my daughter, in her mid-teens, she was going through a rough time. And the doctor and her mother and some other people, like, said, well, we want her to have this antidepressant. And I was so angry. And I lost that battle for about 6 months. My daughter went on antidepressants. And I don't know, it didn't seem to mess her up permanently. But what I do know is that, you know, when I think it does mess up other kids. Absolutely, I think this. Your brain's still developing at that age. You know, it goes up until you're almost 30. 28 years old is the cutoff date. In general, when your brain sort of solidifies and becomes a mature version of what you are. You're screwing with young people's brain chemistry, and that's a crime. And I absolutely believe there will be a day in the future we look back in horror at what we're doing to these young people. It's criminal. But of course, it's highly profitable. And more than that, it's really great in creating drug dependencies on people. You can't tell me that you're creating sharper, better minds by doing this. Sorry, I'm not going to buy that one. And then there's the electronic frequencies. Jason's going to talk about this. But they are everywhere. And they do affect us. You know, for many, many decades, there have been talks and claims about damaging effects of what's known as ESB, electronic stimulation of the brain. And that this can come from it can be weaponized against you, or it can be ambient from technology. It's dangerous and it affects us. And then there's all the cell phones and everything else that's there in our environment. This is not how we evolved. It's not how we're meant to be. And Jason will get into much more detail on this, but it's all of the dangerous effects on us clearly have not yet been fully explored. So we don't even know what we're doing to ourselves. The narcotics that are illegal. One of my early conversations with Catherine, I'll never forget this, talking about Mexico. There's the Mexican Carlos Salinas, who was the brother of Raul. Oh, no. Carlos Salinas was the president of Mexico. His brother, Raul Salinas, was a drug dealer at large. It had happened in around 2000 or so that I think it was over $100 million belonging to Raul Salinas was stopped on its way through the Chase Bank of New York, on its way to a Swiss bank account. Remember when the news story comes out and they're like, oh, the Chase talking head's like, oh, it's really a wonderful thing that we've got procedures in place to check irregular transfers of blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure Raul Salinas was just an idiot who had no idea that his money was going to get checked going through Chase on his way to Switzerland. Are you kidding me? How many times did this guy have his money go through there before it finally gets stopped? I'm guessing someone talked and that person probably was dead 5 minutes after it happened. You know, and I remember talking with Catherine about this. And this was a real eye-opener for me. I was going on one of my rants on the phone with her. I'm like, they should just legalize all the drugs. Damn it. Criminalizing all this. She says, yeah, that's great. You'll just see a banking failure, Richard. And I'm like, wait, what? Banking failure? You might remember that. So, anyway, maybe we can get into that. But point is, of course, it's allowed. Of course, it's legal. I mean, it's not legal, but it's allowed. It's permitted for all kinds of reasons, for money. And it's really handy to keep the population kind of dead-eyed and off their game, and all the other chemicals. So we're not. How can you fight the system when you're out of shape and dull of mind? The answer is you can't. So it's the best way to keep the expendables from organizing and doing anything. It's just you keep them kind of dumb and ignorant, and watching the Super Bowl and watching all the TV and all the other stuff that they, you know, spend their lives doing. And then another way to control people, and this is really good for the more educated, is they're now erasing your identity. So we've all heard about political correctness and identity politics. And that's just the newest form. Actually, the newest form to control, which I didn't even mention here, is basically fake news. The nation of Malaysia just recently banned fake news. In other words, if you were to create, distribute what they consider fake news, you could go to jail or pay a very hefty fine. How about that? UK is not far behind. They're losing their minds over Russia right now. I mean, just goodbye, UK mind, because that's a thing of the past. And they're gonna make their own legislation. You watch against distributing fake news, as they deem it. And this is spreading. Someone told me last week that the EU was legislating against fake news. I don't know to the extent, but it wouldn't shock me if that happens. In other words, the point is, fake news today is what hate speech was 10 years ago, in the sense of it's the leading edge of what authoritarian regimes are now using to censor your speech and to censor your thought. Like 10 years ago, you know, hate speech. Don't say anything racist. Don't say anything sexist. Don't say anything hateful, or you're a bad person, and we will shun you socially. We will prevent you from speaking. We will deplatform you, demonetize you on YouTube, and all these other things to shut you up. But now fake news, I predict, will be in the next coming decade the cutting edge of what authoritarian governments from the U.S. to the Australians to everywhere else will use to monitor, censor, and control free speech. And as Jordan Peterson has said far more eloquently than I could ever say, you need free speech. Free speech isn't just an ordinary right. It is a necessary mechanism by which free societies can function. You cannot have a free society without individuals being allowed to disagree in a civil way. You can't just deplatform people and say you don't have a right to speak, because that's a great way to get people to start murdering each other. If you don't let your opponent speak, you're just pushing them into a corner, so they're going to fight you in other ways. So what makes freedom so amazing is that people who have different opinions are able to express those opinions in a safe manner by talking it out rather than fighting it out. That's the whole point. And what we're seeing now in our society, in all the Western societies, is this is an attack on, you know, the whole identity politics movement is a very, very crafted, it's a carefully crafted, this is not just happened spontaneously. This is being cultivated for a reason by elite with their media arms to promote a kind of mentality that people increasingly, you see them, they're buying into it. Some are pushing back, fortunately. And it's an attack, you know, the whole white guilt phenomenon. It's like Western civilization's bad. They create slaves. Well, they also gave you Beethoven. They also gave you Shakespeare. They also gave you the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson. They gave you a lot of great things, too. So, you know, it's not all like those dead white men are evil. That's a great way to divorce you from your history and from your heritage. Don't let them do it. Don't let them do it. It's a bad road to go down. So the guilt is used against people for them to abdicate their freedom and their power. That's what's going on. And that's not by accident. There's a great lady named Charlotte Iserby. She wrote a book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of the American Public, I think. She's an education expert, and she was an official in the Reagan administration. Very cool lady. And she's talked about this is deliberate. It's not by accident. So, and then, right, as I say here, posing trivial cultural issues, you know, bathrooms, as a major crisis. Meanwhile, you know, entire nations are obliterated. When Libya was taken down in 2011, that was the worst for me. That was the worst. All right. They destroyed the wealthiest nation in Africa, where women could wear what they want, free health care, free housing for the homeless, good place to live. Good place to live. Gaddafi was portrayed as the next Hitler, whatever. And so what do? In the name of human rights, fake Twitter accounts, fake YouTube accounts, fake bombing of the population. Didn't happen. Sorry, didn't happen. Show me the evidence. It's not there. They destroyed that country. Destroyed. Won't recover in our lifetimes. Thanks, guys. Meanwhile, though, we're worked on, let's give, you know, everyone their fully equal, you know, preference rights in this society. Like, where's the oppression? You know, seriously, in the United States. Come on. Meanwhile, we destroy nations, leaving horror, dead bodies in our wake. So go figure. There's a reason for that. That's the reason. So anyway, control over our minds through erasing your identity. It's a big, big part of the equation. And then, of course, Google, Facebook. You know, what was it? Eric Schmidt, I think, of Google. Didn't he say, we're deranking RT now in our search engine? It's like, yeah, great. Great idea. Derank all of the alternative sources of information for people so they never get to see it. Good idea. That's wonderful. Because they're Russian. They're awful. Another way is they just poison your soul. I mean, that's Lady Gaga. I could have pulled out any number of images from our culture today. What has happened to Western culture? Seriously. Like, it has gone off the rails. Freedom of expression is one thing, but like when you're overtly bringing in, and like a lot of these music videos, like they're overtly totalitarian, police state type videos. You know, I could have pulled out one of those from a Gaga video and it was a jackboot, like Nazi looking police stormtrooper types. Like, what the hell? So there's this whole new culture being brought in. It's like a dissolution of what is actually a healthy, vibrant, loving culture into something totally dystopian by design. Dark things being promoted. I think of popular music. You know, if you listen to popular music in the 60s and 70s, it's like, it's not just disco. That's like the ultimate mindless upbeat tempo. Tracy and I like disco music, but, you know, any of the, we dig our disco. But there's like any of the pop music of that era. It's like, they believe that they could make a better world. And it's in all of the culture at that time. You know? As goofy as some of the hippies might have been, like they were trying to make a better world. And they believed they could. Where do you get that now? Like the culture has become so dark and so oppressive. It's like hope has been explicitly siphoned out of your culture by design. It's not an accident. It's not just culture doing its own thing. There was a great 19th century historian named Jakob Burckhardt of Switzerland. I'm a big fan of him. And he wrote a book called Culture and Society once. Force and Freedom, excuse me. It's a collection of essays. And he postulated that there are three fundamental forces in a society. Culture, religion, and the state. And it was a very interesting analysis. And he basically saw the three of them as kind of an interplay. Like, so culture influencing the state and religion influencing culture and the state influencing both, and so on. But what I would suggest to you is that we're in a position now where culture increasingly is being controlled by the state. Not 100%, but where what we think are normal cultural expressions increasingly are manipulations of us by a hierarchy. Let me just back up there. A culture that is so sexualized and trivial and fantasy-based. It's everywhere. And, you know, you can now see it with the next generation gaming, virtual reality. You're going to have a whole generation of kids on pharmaceuticals, bad food, no job outlook for themselves, and they're going to be whiling away their time in VR headsets with all that radiation coming out of them. Jason will talk about that. In some kind of fantasy world that, considering how awful the world that they're moving into is going to be much more attractive for them just to, you know, spend their whole lives doing fantasy stuff. Well, you know, if they become part of the expendable class, that's what they're going to do. Why? Well, I was kind of talking about this before, because more and more people are expendable in the minds of those people at the top. Memo, we're not actually expendable. We're not expendable, but we are seen that way increasingly. So the idea is to transform our culture and our society to create as docile and malleable a population as possible. Weaponizing the people. This is something Catherine mentioned in her article, and I thought, is this true? So against, you know, whatever new target you need to weaponize them against, racists, sexists, or Trump, or Putin, or whomever. Get the people worked up against that target over there. Meanwhile, it's like a great shell game going on. Don't look at this stuff over here. Just focus on these people who don't want to, you know, give transgender bathrooms their due. You know, like they're the evil ones. So that's it. And increasingly and explicitly to eliminate the idea of freedom, particularly economic freedom, I would say, is an idea that is being slowly just taken away. They can't do it all at once, but they're doing it. They're making it happen. I created this little graphic. I like this. So I was just sitting down one day thinking, so what are our basic human needs and what are our higher human needs? So our basic human needs would include things like food. You have to have food to live. Career, friends, sex, love. Those things, like we need those things in our life. Family, money. Higher needs. I include love as a higher need as well as a basic need. That's the only one that I have in both. But higher needs would be like your higher mental capacity, like your creativity, your ideas. The things that make you a higher, a true human, the highest level of human, are what I would say your higher needs are. What would I would say? Spirituality. I think we have a popular culture that promotes the one, the basic needs, highlights it, and buries the higher needs so that they're like not there. Katy Perry at the Super Bowl, or, you know, Jersey Shore, or whatever. You know, the stuff that just says, let me take your higher needs and throw them into the trash. And that's the purpose. And it's important because if you don't have your higher needs front center in your vision, you will forget who you are. You will forget that you don't have to put up with this type of control, right? So meanwhile, so that's like the human hierarchy and where they're moving. And there's this whole UFO phenomenon that's there. Remember that. So what's happening? There's a very, very lot of activity going on while the population is being dumbed down and controlled and frightened and impoverished, right? So what's going on is a major infrastructure is developing on our money. And it's an open system where that money is going out, far away. What they're doing with it is something that I think we're going to be doing some real study of in the coming months and years. But one of the things that they're doing is they're developing a secret space program. And by the way, I'm sure you are mostly or all familiar with this story that Catherine really is fully responsible for breaking, which is the theft of $21 trillion with a T, dollars over the past 20 years since 1998. Yes. And she's done this with working with Michigan State University professor Mark Skidmore and his hardworking graduate students. And what they've done is they've gone through the DOD and HUD financial records. And so this is only a partial. And they've come up with $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments, as they're euphemistically called, missing money. This was just covered on RT's show by Lee Camp, who is very, very sharp and funny. And he brilliantly, this is on YouTube, so go look up Lee Camp, $21 trillion, and you'll see, gives about 10, 15 minutes on this, and he just nails it. And he points out the criminal absurdity of the situation. But the point is that money, you know, you probably all remember after right before 9/11, when Donald Rumsfeld, with the new Bush administration, goes before Congress, the House Armed Services Committee, and says, yeah, as crazy as it sounds, we can't account for $2.3 trillion, if that's believable, he said. And there was, I read the transcript, and there was like laughter by the House Armed Services Committee after he said that. $2.3 trillion He didn't say missing money. He said, he might have said undocumentable adjustments or whatever it was. Anyone know the exact quote? Unaccountable. Unaccountable. Thank you. If that's believable. Ha, ha, ha. He said it again on September 10th. Catherine said, that's going to break it. Nothing can stop it now. Then comes 9/11, and oops, something did stop it from coming out. That's eight times the Pentagon budget for that year, by the way, which was $310 billion. How do you lose track of eight times your annual budget? That's another question. Catherine could answer that better than I could. Her estimate, along with Skidmore's, is, I mean, you know, we're spitballing at this point, but $50 billion?
Trillion.
Trillion. $50 trillion is not an outrageous guess, it seems. So when you think of the entire U.S. debt as a little over $20 trillion, like the amount that they've proven so far would literally cover the entire United States debt for all time up till now. It's like, okay. So that's why this is the greatest shell game in history. So there's machinations going on. So everything that's happening affects us in the deepest, most profound way possible. And yet you look around society and people are just asleep at the switch, zombies. Jim Mars, late Jim Mars, had the best title for a book that I've ever come across. He never wrote this book, so I want to do it one day. Book was called, going to be called Zombie Nation. Zombie Nation. It was like going to be a combination of people being asleep, drugged, pharmaceuticaled, pacified. Perfect. And plus the whole emphasis on zombies and culture makes it just perfect. Zombie Nation. Yeah, that's zombie world is the goal. Because you can't rob someone blind if they're in a state of order and organization and intelligence. You've got to throw chaos into the mix, and you have to destroy nations. Like, how else could you steal, you know, $29 trillion worth of oil under the ground in Iraq? You can't do that if it's in a state of order. You got to take the oil fields and you privatize them and you rob. There's stacks and stacks of money leaving that country in 04 and 05. That's a whole other story. So I guess I'm getting toward the end here, and I don't know how we're doing for time. 2 hours. Good. So as I say here, I think the UFO cover-up has facilitated, has not necessarily completely created, but facilitated the creation of a breakaway civilization at a bad time. You know, if the UFO phenomenon had fallen into our laps, maybe at a different phase in our development, when human beings were still really necessary for the elite, it's possible. I mean, I can theorize that it's possible that the situation might have been different and more open. At least I play this little game in my mind that it would be possible. Like, this idea of an open government would actually maybe kind of sort of hold a little bit. I don't really know that it would, but I like to think it's possible. Certainly what's happened is that after World War II, the wheels kept spinning ever faster toward consolidation of a global hierarchy, and particularly, especially since 1991-92. Absolutely. People ask me frequently, about the idea of disclosure of UFOs. If you're new to the UFO field, just take my word. Like, that's a big issue people like to talk about. When's the end of secrecy? Disclosure. I even wrote a book by that title. What would happen, if the secret were to end? How would it change our world? And what might cause that secret to end? And, my feeling is that there will never be a voluntary disclosure, at least an honest one, of the UFO phenomenon. Not ever. The only time there will be one is if the secret holders are pushed right to that wall with a lot of pressure against them and they're forced to give up something. And there's one important quote that I'll never forget. It came from Alan Dulles, former CIA director. Best way to keep a secret is to pretend to share it. And so what I think will happen is, they'll give up some information, like the New York Times did last December 16th when they came out with a couple of UFO stories. You pretend to give up some information. By doing so, you control the narrative. easy, and you thereby cauterize the wound so that you stop the hemorrhaging of the real information. So that's going to be the only... So if there's any kind of little disclosure of this, it's going to be up to us, any of us who care, to keep pushing, because it won't be a full and honest and open disclosure. I can... If there's anything I'm sure of, I'm sure of that. What the desired goal, sorry to say this, is a long, long dark night of global totalitarianism. That's the desired goal by certain people who've got the power. Doesn't mean they're going to get it. After all, we're here. There's more of us. And not only are we smarter than they are, because I think we are, but we're also more ethical than they are. And for those of us who care, Catherine may give her Gideon story to you at some point during this week. Basically, a small group of people who have ethics and competency, who are determined and focused, can take down the enemy. So that's what we can do. But we have to recognize a few things. Like, we're not alone. There's someone else operating here with whatever. That's a whole... I haven't even gotten into that. Like, what is their agenda? Maybe we can discuss that later today. But there is someone siphoning off our power, our wealth, our future. Our future is being held hostage, essentially, by lies. We're being controlled. And if we don't recognize that we're being controlled, don't even bother trying. Like, that's the first and hardest step, is to recognize that you've been played. If you don't recognize that, then just go out and enjoy the sunshine as long as you can, because that's all. There's no point. You got to recognize what's going on around you. So this is my final slide here. So we can become liberated. First of all, you know, I ask myself, why do I even bother doing this? Like, am I really thinking that, oh, I'm going to, like, take down the evil system? Like, no, I don't really think personally in most of my lucid moments that I can do it. I'm just one guy. I do what I do because, honestly, I love what I do, and I can't imagine doing anything else. That's really what it comes down to. Because, like, I'm fanatically devoted to doing this because it's just, like, it's become who I am, and I believe in it. And so that's the reward for me, to be honest with you, is consciousness and liberation that I personally experience in my life by stripping away as much illusion as I can, and thereby achieving as much personal growth as I can do. So if that's the best reward I can get, then okay, I'll take it. You know, a lot of people throughout history haven't had that much, so that's pretty good. But if we're going to achieve liberation as a society, A, we have to work together, and we have to see the deception and control system for what it is. And that's hard to do. It's really hard to do. Like, even when I was in my 30s, it was hard. And it's harder the older you get. Like, the longer you're in that system, like in The Matrix when Morpheus says, you know, it's our policy, we don't take someone after a certain time, because the adjustment's too difficult. I think that's right. It's like, the more ensconced someone is in the system, the more rewards they get, psychological rewards, it becomes really hard to just rip yourself out of that. I was at the... If I had been much older than my mid-30s, it might have been tough for me. You know, I was becoming sort of involved in my own place in that system, and it was hard to break away, but I'm very glad that I did. So you have to see it. You have to recognize that you've been played. Then the next thing, this is really important and helpful, is you teach others. And the only way to teach others is you have to formulate the ideas in your own mind. You can't teach others if you're just riffing incoherently. You've got to think through. And so we all know that teachers learn more than any of their students when they teach a class. There's a reason for that. You have to organize the structure of knowledge so that you understand it. And by doing that, you're actually benefiting yourself more than anything else. And then by teaching others, you are turning those light bulbs on above other people's heads. Yes, that's very important, because we have to shine light as much as possible. But you're also making yourself more powerful, you know. And by finding that power, it's... I am absolutely convinced we've all got it, and none of us know the full extent of our power. The other thing to do is, to whatever extent possible, feasible, practical, you become independent of the system. In other words, don't feed the machine. And I know it's hard. We all have jobs, and you got to pay the mortgage or whatever, but there are degrees. Someone mentioned they homeschooled their kids. I did that. I homeschooled my kids, my son, throughout his entire period, and my daughter through the age of 11, until she begged me because she saw the movie High School Musical with all the kids with lockers. She saw Zac Efron, fell in love. Dad, I want to go to school. I want a locker. I was like, are you old enough to be taking drugs? Because you sound real odd. No, I want to do it. So she went. But fortunately, the homeschooling gave her an independent mind. She went in and she took over the place. We all become independent by degrees. And just do your best. But do it ethically. Do it in a way that you can live with yourself. You know, what you don't want to do is what, you know, a lot of times we see in someone who's old and right near the end of the road, and they have that moment. It's like, I've just wasted my whole life, and you see it, and it's there. Like, I've gone through my whole life, and I haven't done the important things. A story that I've always recommended for my entire life is by Tolstoy, The Death of Ivan Illich. If you haven't read it, highly recommend it. 60 pages. It takes the 1,500 pages of Tolstoy's genius. You take a little 60-page slice, and it's all about what is life worth living for. And he'll tell you. Because Ivan Illich was a guy who did have that moment at the end of his life, like, what if I lived my life wrong? And he did. And Tolstoy lets you know. And Ivan Illich realizes he blew it. It's easy to blow it. It's easy to blow it. So what we have to do is you do your best to become independent, to teach others, to inspire other people, to inspire yourself. And that's it. That's all we can do. And one thing I love to do at night, and Tracy will tell you, is like I read books on ancient history. I have nothing to do with UFOs. I just read all the time. And, you know, our history is just filled with one bloody-minded atrocity after another. It's really true. A lot of suffering, a lot of injustice, a lot of awful things. But through it all, we somehow keep going, and people survive. Well, we're really resilient. So I believe this is what we're dealing with now. Other people before us have had even harder crises to deal with. Like this, for us, as smart as we are, as focused as we are, this battle is a walk in the park compared with what other people have had to deal with. So I believe that we can win this battle and that we can achieve the changes that we need to make to create a world where there's at least some semblance of justice and hope and humanity. And with that, thank you very much for your time.